Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Michael Shine. I represent Calvin Evans, Jr., the son of the decedent. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
All right. Proceed.
In March 2006, Cal Sr. made a will leaving his horse ranch in Sultan to his son, Cal Jr., based on what was by then an executed oral agreement under which Cal Jr. moved his family from Idaho to Sultan to care for the ranch and for his father. The trial court found that Cal Sr. was competent and not under undue influence when he made that will. So the will was valid. However, the trial court found that Cal Jr. should recover nothing under the new extension of the Slayer statute against financial abuse. How this court rules in this case will decide whether the settled expectations of thousands of elders in their estate plans will be set aside or thrown into litigation between their children. Canese's estate, of course, has long held that the right of testamentary disposition of one's property is by law absolute and a valuable right.
Are you suggesting that the test for whether a person has testamentary capacity and the test for whether they're a vulnerable adult are the same, and because the court found that there was testamentary capacity in this case, that the finding that Cal Sr. was a vulnerable adult was an error?
No, Judge Spearman, I'm not. I think that the statute, we have to look at the statute for the test of vulnerable adult, and that statute's in Title 74, and it's set out in the briefs. But there are six crucial safeguards that are built into the extension of financial abuse into the Slayer statute, and I think the legislature put those safeguards in because it was aware of the competing policy of the need to protect valid testamentary dispositions and didn't want them upset willy-nilly. And those safeguards are, first, the party seeking to disinherit needs to show its case by clear, cogent, and convincing evidence. Second, it has to demonstrate that the abuse was willful. Only willful abuse counts. And it must prove that the exploitation was made at the time when the individual was a vulnerable adult, the elder was a vulnerable adult. Fourth, the court must consider whether the elder actually ratified the use of his or her resources. Fifth, the trial court should exercise its discretion to temper the extreme penalty of disinheritance. And sixth, financial exploitation must be limited to actions taken for illegal or improper purposes. All those are statutory. The statutory citations are right at page one of our reply brief and are necessary to prevent the protections for abusive elders from being turned into a way to undermine their estates. Here, there was no clear, cogent, and convincing evidence of willfulness or that any improper abuse occurred at a time when Cal Sr. was a vulnerable adult. Cal Sr. and Cal Jr. agreed that Cal Jr. would run the horse farm and take the income. There's nothing improper or illegal.
What part of the statute that defines a vulnerable adult are you relying on to argue that there was insufficient evidence to reach that conclusion?
Well, if you look at the vulnerable adult statute, and I will look at it for just a moment, we've argued that he was not a vulnerable adult until there was a finding in 2008 in June setting up the estate. And it's Appendix 12, I think, is where that statute 7434020 is set out, Appendix 12 to the brief of respondent. And if you just tick down through the elements.
Until the guardianship was set up,
right,
there was insufficient evidence to find that he was unable to care for himself?
Right. And that is, there's a lot of evidence. And, you know, you have to look at it, I think, in this context, though, in terms of was there clear, cogent, and convincing evidence by which Cal Jr. should have known that his father was a vulnerable adult. Most of the actions that he's accused of were in 2004 and 2005. And at that time, you know, Dr. Eisenhower saw him in early 2006, said he was fine when discussing subjects of interest to him, like airplanes, ranches, and land values, that he was coherent, expressed himself in a linear manner.
Well, you know, I suppose there was conflicting evidence on that point.
Well, it's,
and why would not the trial court be permitted to weigh that evidence and reach a conclusion? And even if we disagree and would have reached a different conclusion, is the evidence so is there such a lack of evidence that the trial court there was insufficient evidence to support the trial court's finding?
Well, first you have to look at this with a higher standard because of the clear, cogent, and convincing evidence standard. So that's one argument. The other is that it's just you need to look at the consequences of your decision. I mean, if you don't implement these safeguards I've pointed out, it will have very serious effects on estates throughout, because there are thousands of instances in which elder children are caring for or adult children are caring for elders who are at varying states of senescence, if you will, and each one of these has to make a judgment.
I think we're more concerned really about the facts in this case.
Well, I understand, but each one of these has to make a judgment. And if a person before them is told by, you know, a doctor who's a specialist says that he's coherent, expresses himself in a linear manner, if his attorney of 30-some-odd years, Chuck Dyson, says he was always competent, he came in, he was clean, he was well-dressed, he was chipper, all these things are in the record. And then you also have to look at whether there was an improper purpose here, because the purpose was exactly to carry out what he contracted to do with his father, which was take care of the horse ranch, use the proceeds, plow them back into the horse ranch, engage in back-breaking labor. And he put $174,000 of his own money into the property. He put endless hours of labor in. As a matter of law, we have argued, under these circumstances, you cannot simply turn around and say that he's a financial abuser. He's a regular child, a favored child of this elder who's working hard to care for his father. The other...
There was other evidence with regard to the finances, the money, the Social Security checks that countervail against that, do they not?
Only the Social Security checks, which was much later. That was, I think, 2008, 2009. He did use that money for feed. But if this court believes
taxes.
That there's a special provision in there for this, we're talking about $4,600 worth of Social Security checks, which he paid back. And for that, he's been disinherited from $1 million. The legislature put a provision, it's 170.172, under which the trial court should have tempered its discretion if it felt that that was an appropriate basis to find abuse. Thank you, Your Honors.
We have 2 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Lorna Corrigan. I represent the respondent Sansing in this matter. In 2005, when Cal Jr. moved with his family to the ranch to take care of his father, Cal Evans Sr., Cal Evans Sr.'s estate contained over $1 million of liquid assets in addition to the real estate holdings. By 2011, when Cal Jr. remained on the ranch in violation of a court order ejecting him, there was so little money left that the guardian had to sell two properties, one of which had been specifically devised to two other heirs of the estate to care for Cal Evans Sr., who was supposed to have been cared for by his son, Cal Evans Jr.
What once Jr. moved on to the property, what was the source of the funds that were going to pay, that Sr. was going to consume in order to live? Was it only Social Security?
He had liquid assets of him.
Well, was it only Social Security? Was he going to spend his own liquid assets or sell them off?
For his care? Is that the question?
Well, for his dinner. For lunch, dinner, breakfast, for the cost of whatever it takes to live.
We've never, it would be his own funds. We didn't contend at trial, and we don't contend now, that Cal Evans Jr. had to support his father financially. What the trial court...
No, I'm just wondering, what was the source of the money that Sr. was going to live off of?
He had income from the sale of property in Duval. He had a real estate contract. He had an income of $3,000 a month from the trainer on the horse ranch that was being produced to the farm.
The $3,000 from the ranch? Well, Sr. wasn't going to live on that, right?
Well, he could. He was living.
Well, no, that's Cal Jr.'s money. That's in your argument in the trial court in your brief, that Cal Jr. was supposed to take care of the ranch and have that $3,000 a month income. And he shouldn't have been tapping into these other things because that $36,000 a year for his family was enough. I mean, we can't spend the same money twice, right?
No, I think I misapprehended your question. I thought you were talking about it at the inception. When Cal Jr. came to the ranch to live there, the idea was that Cal Jr. would supply the physical care. It wasn't necessarily that he had to financially support his father. His father had plenty of money in the bank. He could pay for groceries for himself.
So his father wasn't, that $3,000 was going to Cal Jr.?
That's correct.
Okay. And then did it, at trial, was it, is there something I can see in the trial record about how we can see what money was actually used for seniors' care then?
I don't know that the trial court record specifies, for example, who bought groceries. I know that at one point in time, there came a time, I believe in 2005, where Cal Sr.'s dollars were being used to, because he'd been caring for himself, despite the fact that Cal Jr. moved to the ranch, he was literally cooking his own meals, even though he was in his 70s and having difficulty. But there came a time in 2005, and this is in the record, where Cal Jr. paid somebody else using Cal Sr.'s funds to come in and do the physical labor of caring for Cal Sr. So the physical labor, which was supposed to have been Cal Jr.'s job, that was the consideration for inheriting the estate, was supposed to have come from Cal Jr. It was supposed to have been his labor. Nobody even said that Cal Sr. couldn't pay for his own groceries. He needed somebody physically to make sure that he got meals and that he got out of bed and so forth. Cal Jr. wasn't doing that. Instead of doing what he'd promised to do, he hired somebody to do the physical labor of caring for his father using his father's funds. So the whole consideration of caring for his father fell to the wayside. Another egregious example is that his father's teeth were falling
out. Well, I'm not sure. Why is it egregious? I mean, he came on to work the ranch, right? He was going to take care of the ranch.
The record shows that the original understanding was not that Cal Jr. was going to run the ranch, because when Cal Jr. came to the ranch, his father had a caretaker for the ranch. He had a trainer who was operating the facility and producing $3,000 a month. What the record demonstrates is that Cal Sr. said, if you come to the ranch and take care of me, you will inherit the ranch. His father had somebody who was running the ranch. The record shows that when Cal Jr. got there, not only was he not fully caring for his father, he fired the trainer at the ranch, so now there's nobody operating it. And then after the deal was struck, he comes to his father and says,
So what was the difference between what the trainer was paid and what the person was paid who was hired to come in and take physical care of Cal Sr.? What was the net difference?
I can't tell you the dollar amount, Your Honor. I don't know that the actual amount.
Well, is there a way to infer that that's nefarious? If the trainer was making more than the caretaker, it would have been a net benefit to Cal Sr.
I'm not sure I'm tracking the inquiry.
Well, this seems like simple math to me. You've got one employee that got fired and another employee that got hired. What was the difference in wages?
I can't tell Your Honor the specific difference in wages. What I can tell you is that we ended up doing both, because now we've got an employee who's hired to do the physical labor using Cal Sr.'s funds, and after Jr. fired the trainer who was producing $3,000 a month because Cal Jr. after the fact says, well, wait a minute, now I'm here and I'm taking care of you, but now you have to pay me and you have to give me a quarter of the estate in addition to the ranch, and that's in the record. That's what he insisted on, or he threatened to leave. And then after Cal Jr. fired the trainer, he brings in his own trainer, and then he spends $15,000 of his father's money buying a mobile home because he said, well, now the trainer has to live here, and now the trainer has to have a first-class horse facility and produce all this money. So ultimately, the operations under Cal Jr. were producing as much as $21,000 a month, and Cal Jr. never accounted for those dollars to his father. So now his father's paying for a caretaker, now his father's paying $15,000 to get a new caretaker for the or a new trainer. The trainer's producing income, and the income's going to Cal Jr., not to Dad. So he wasn't Cal Evans Sr.
And what should have happened is the family should have moved on to the ranch and assumed responsibility for the ranch, but keep the trainer and take care of Senior in exchange for $36,000 minus whatever else it took to take care of Senior, because you can't spend Senior's money taking care of Senior because that's part of the deal?
I think what was originally contemplated as demonstrated.
So it was no more than $36,000. Live on the ranch and have no more than $36,000 available to live on for the family. That was the deal.
There was no
up to $36,000.
There was no deal that required Cal Evans Jr. to run anything on the ranch. That was all something he concocted after he moved there. The deal was, come to the ranch and live with me. There was no restriction on Cal Evans Jr. Nobody said he couldn't have a job, couldn't run an excavating business.
He's supposed to take the $36,000, right? Junior was supposed to get the $36,000, right?
After he moved on the ranch, when he began making essentially threats to leave, a deal was struck saying, okay, you got your new trainer in here.
Why is it so hard to get in? And I'm really trying to get a handle on this. And we've tried the case. There's findings of fact. In a real straightforward sense, I'm reading the briefs. It seems like Junior was supposed to get the $36,000.
I'm a little confused about what the $36,000.
$3,000 a month from the ranch.
Correct.
He was supposed to get that, right?
Okay. Ultimately,
right?
That was agreed on, yes.
And then he was not supposed to spend any of Cal Senior's money caring for Cal Senior, right? You just told me that 4 minutes ago.
Well, I think there's a distinction between expenses for Cal Sr., which Cal Jr. was not responsible for, and providing care for his father, which he was responsible
for. What is the finding of fact with regard to that distinction? What's in and what's out?
I think the findings of fact are clear that the understanding was that he would come and care for his father. There was no finding of fact that at the time he moved onto the ranch, he had an expectation of, Cal Jr., I mean, had an expectation of income from the ranch. So caring for the father meant living with him, making sure he got meals. It's correct that I can't cite to a specific finding of fact that he was to feed his father and put his pajamas on. But there was no indication in the record of any agreement that Cal Jr. was supposed to obtain an independent income for himself. And that's what ended up happening. He didn't just have an income. He helped himself to his father's assets. So in answer, I hope in answer to Your Honor's question.
Well, okay. We've done as best as we can.
Your Honor, finding of fact 28. Says that Cal Sr. told Jack Choate, who was his neighbor, he wanted to have Cal Sr. sell his house in Idaho and move to the Sultan Ranch to work it, then give it to Cal Jr. And 29, he intended to leave the 70-acre parcel to him. And what Cal Jr. testified, but I don't believe there was a finding directly on this point, was that his father told him that he would come and have in excess, now it's making $3,000 a month. He could come, he could work the ranch, and if he can do better, he can have the excess income. And plus, he said to his son, and this was the testimony.
The judge might not have believed his testimony.
Well, that may be, but I'm just telling you what the record shows because you wanted to know.
Well, I want to know what the trial court found. That's what I'm worried about.
Yeah.
If the trial court didn't believe it, the fact that it's in the record.
Well, it didn't make a contrary finding. It just kind of passed that by. I believe it said that he was intended to have in excess of, $3,000 a month, if available. I want to make a key point about this case, and that is that I know there's some concern about the Social Security checks, and I don't stand here and purport to justify that, but I do justify each and every other thing that this son did for his father. And the deal included taking care of the ranch. And a horse trainer does not take care of a ranch. A horse trainer trains horses. Now, he hired a replacement. And that's really not the issue here as to why one was fired and another was hired. The key thing is that that ranch would have gone to waste, and that was his father's property had he not cared for it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both. The next matter is Heinzig versus